Back together again, you and I chatting it up round the radio on a Thursday, May 15, 2025 on Connecticut Today. We highlighted a couple of members of the state's U.S. House delegation that will reportedly run for re-election despite calls from many fellow Democrats to try and appeal to get younger voters in the fold and keep them away from the Trump White House. Sacred Heart University political science professor and scholar in residence, our buddy Dr. Gary Rose, dropped by to chat about whether or not Governor Ned Lamont will run for re-election next year. CBS News legal analyst Thane Rosenbaum and Landmark Legal Foundation VP of Legal Affairs Mike O'Neill took some time to break down today's U.S. Supreme Court arguments on possible limits to so-called birthright citizenship.
And I don't know whether it's out-and-out laziness, out-and-out stupidity, out-and-out muscle memory, out-and-out not caring, but I am constantly amazed at the number of people who will vote for people on either side of the aisle when they get to their 60s, 70s, and now their 80s. I'm constantly amazed by people who will put the welfare and faith of the country and of the state in the hands of people that just keep getting older and older and older. Where is the fresh thinking? Where is the idea that, hey, maybe somebody closer to my age, and I'm not even talking my age here, but just in general, saying the people are thinking, what is it? What's the infatuation with old people? And yeah, I know I'm 64. I'm not 75. I'm not 80. I'm not in my early 80s, for God's sake.
Well, you're old, Paul.
Yeah, relatively I am. But I would at least know when to step aside. Why am I starting with this? I got this story today. This popped into my story queue here. And there are some Connecticut people mentioned in this. Democrats' oldest lawmakers are mostly running again. My God, get out. All of you, get out. On the Republican side, too. Can you all go home? Enough. No wonder there's a logjam. And I, for one, was not in favor of a 78-year-old guy being president. Get out, all of you. How about some fresh thinking? Good God. Democrats are at war with themselves over their aging leadership, but many of the party's oldest members of Congress are still running for re-election. The fossils have no idea what to do with themselves. Good God. This list here, Maxine Waters, Democrat, California, 86, 86. Get a hobby, Maxine. Go home. Rosa DeLauro, 82. Come on, Rosa. Enough. Enough. Go back to Worcester Street. Sit out on the stoop there. Say hi to everybody. 82. John Garamendi, Democrat, California, 80. Doris Matsui, 80. Bonnie Watson Coleman, 80. Most people I know that are 80 are dead. Marcy Kaptur, 78. Jerry Nadler, 77. Zoe Lofgren, 77. And what is this? And don't worry, there is some on the Republican side, too. Chuck Grassley, 91. What in the hell is Chuck Grassley doing in Congress at 91 years old? Have you heard him speak? He sounds like a stuck traffic light. Mitch McConnell, 83. I know he's had health issues. He shouldn't be in Congress at 83 years old. Jim Risch, Republican, Iowa, born May 3rd, 1943. He's 82. Hal Rogers, Republican, Kentucky. He's 87. What are you doing? Get out. Step aside. Have some grace, all of you people, Republican and Democrat, have some grace. Say it's been fun here, but push yourself away from the free smorgasbord of privilege there. My God. And the text and the context of this Axios article is, well, you know, the Democrats are having problems with younger people. You think? Because the Democrats, and even some Republicans, they look up at the gallery there and they say, geez, are those members of Congress or is that a carnival ride? 86, 82, 80. Well, Paul, aren't you? You're being ageist. No, I'm not. Because if I was in Congress, I would get out long before I turned 80. Trust me. I'd have something deeper to do with my life. Hopefully I'll be doing this in the 70s or in my 70s, you know, knock on wood. But my God, John Larson, he's in this article 76. He froze up during a House floor speech in February. He had a partial seizure and he's running for re-election again. What? What is it with these people? The arrogance. I could see if you have physical problems and you're in your 50s or 60s, you want to gut it through. But what? Please explain this to me. What is it? Is it power? Is it money? I don't know. Are they so hooked as to what they're going to do? And this came to the forefront because Rosa DeLauro got into it the other day with Robert F. Kennedy Jr. And some people saying, God, how old is that woman? Now, listen, I've known Rosa for years. I get it. It's not just her. And I get it. People have the freedom to vote. If they don't want to vote for an old person, they don't have to. But again, those older lawmakers, they're Republican and Democrat, they clog up the pipeline. At a moment in this country's history, at a moment in our state's history, when new vibrant thinking is needed, carnival ride, that's what you're getting in the House and Senate in D.C., 203-333-9422. Representative Danny Davis, Democrat, Illinois, told Axios he'll decide in a month or so whether or not to rerun. He's running. He's 83. Go home, Congressman Davis. Please go home, sit on the porch, get the newspaper, get a cup of coffee, and resign in some grace. My God, these people. I'm sorry. Every so often, I just have to vent on this. Can you tell? So here's my question to you. As we start the day looking at the contingent of people who should have left 10 years ago. I there was a time I was vehemently, with every fiber of my breath, against term limits. Saying, hey, we have term limits. They come every 2 years for the U.S. House. Or the state house. We have term limits for every 2 years for the House and Senate and for the state house and state Senate. I'm back to the term limit thing again. So what should the maximum age be to run for re-election to Congress? How about a maximum number of House or Senate terms? What do you think about that? Now, I don't want to have everybody go home when they're 45 or 50, but can we stop at 70? Can we stop at 72? Does it do the country any good at all to have people in their low and mid and upper 80s making laws? What is it with today's modern politician when they just don't know to say enough? And I know what you're going to say. Well, you know, people could vote for someone else. No, no, no. It's not that easy. You don't understand. And a lot of you people over the years have asked me on shows like this, well, you know, why are you so bent on term limits? Because over the years, both parties, both nationally and both here in Connecticut, have made it increasingly difficult for challenges. Now, if I was an elected official of either party, imagine that, I would welcome a challenge. I would tell whatever party I was affiliated with, Democrats or Republicans, don't keep them off the ballot. Hey, I welcome the challenge. And if I lose, that means I was doing a lousy job. How about that? How about I'm not afraid, if I was going to be a politician, perish the thought, of me saying, hey, go ahead, judge me every 2 years. But this is mind-numbing. And this article is not from some far right wing publication. It's from Axios. that has a decided progressive stance, which is fine. But here's this story here. The Democrats' oldest lawmakers are mostly running again, which includes Rosa DeLauro. And she wants to run, fine. But my God, go home. It's enough. She's 82. John Larson is 76. Is the power that intoxicating? It must be a rush, I understand, to have people tell you all the time how wonderful you are and to come and get a tour of your office and a tour of the Capitol. And I don't besmirch anybody for doing that. But after a while, after 10 or 15 terms, isn't it enough? Help me out here. Is this an addiction? Is it the power? Well, you know, if the people want to vote for me, yeah. But how about you be the bigger person? And I'm not necessarily talking about anybody in our delegation, but everybody else around the country. And don't tell me you can be, and I know what they'll say, well, our staffs, we have good staffs. They keep us abreast of the issues. Yeah, okay, stop, please. Yeah, they can give you all the briefing papers you want. But here's my point. Unless you are living a lifestyle that you can relate to of a lot of the people in your district, you don't know what they're feeling. You don't know what it's like. A lot of those people in Congress have a lot of money. They're very well connected. So I don't want to hear about how great of a staff you have and, oh, my God, I get these briefing papers. And I took it. That's my favorite, too. When some CEO of a company takes, oh, they gave me a tour of the plant or the facility. Now I understand. No, you don't. God's sake, you don't understand. My God. Maxine Waters, 86. Rosa DeLauro, 82. John Larson, 76. Bonnie Watson Coleman, 80. Lloyd Doggett of Texas, 78. Really? Don't you have grandkids? Don't you have a nice group you can get together and read a book with? I don't know. Listen, I'm not telling anybody what to do with their lives. I'm not. But doesn't it come to a point? And you know me, I told you, even in the Trump elections, anybody over 70 bothers me. Running. Again, is it that intoxicating? Where is the pride in saying, hey, you know what? This has been great, but enough. It's mind-boggling. And the point of the article is, like I said, well, maybe this is why the Democrats are having problem connecting with younger voters. You think, Einstein? You think? Really? You expect somebody who's 25 years old to relate to somebody who's 80. How does that work? Paul in Bethel starts us off today. Paul, how are you, sir?
Good. How are you?
I'm good.
The thought that comes to my mind is do something you love, you'll never work a day in your life.
Yeah.
And that's probably why they're all still there, because they love what they do and it can't compare to anything else. I don't know. I'm all for term limits. I think it'd be great, but that's why they're still there. So,
Paul.
Go ahead.
No. And the fact that I get in to do this job every day, Monday through Friday, for 4 hours, I don't consider this work. This is great. Yeah, sure, I get paid for it, but so I can kind of understand that. But you know, after a while, Paul, even myself with this, I'm gonna say enough. You know, you have to. To keep the business viable, you have to.
I can't wait for the day that I retire. No matter how much I love what I'm doing, I've got plans. I want to do something else.
Well, good for you, Paul. Good for you. Thanks, yeah. Paul. I appreciate it. Another Paul. Paul in Bethel, right here on WICC. So, again, this is not to besmirch any of these lawmakers. I get it. But you cannot tell me that when you have lawmakers that are 70, 75, 80, 82, 86 years old, of either party. I don't care how great your staffs are. I don't care how good of briefing books they write for you. You're out of touch with them. You just are. And part of being an effective legislator is being in touch with them. It's living the life or the lives that many of the young men and women live in your district. And it doesn't mean that you can't do 5, 10, 15, or 20 years, but come on, please, please. After 70 or 75, have you been there 15 or 20 years? Enough. All right, before we get to our guest, Dr. Gary Rose, Sacred Heart University, we'll have Gary give us his two cents on this. Now, I played this yesterday, and it's from our buddy, our pal, Mike Cerulli of News 8, who also hosts the Mike Cerulli Show every Saturday, 10 to 1, right here on WICC. And Mike was chatting with the governor yesterday at a press briefing, and the magic question, hey, Ned, are you running again?
Have you made a decision? Do you know which way you're leaning when it comes to next year's election?
Look, I think about it because you asked me about it. I think I'm just going to put all that off till the summer. I think that gives everybody plenty of time and me a chance to sit down with Annie and just finalize things.
All right, sit down and finalize things with Annie. Maybe she's the boss. Joining us right now, we always love to have this guy on to talk about that. Things all political, Connecticut and nationwide. Sacred Heart University political science professor and scholar in residence, Dr. Gary Rose. Gary, how are you, my friend? Been a while. How are you?
Yeah, good to hear from you, Paul. How
so are you? Good. Was that a non-answer answer or an answer non-answer? What would you think of the governor there?
I know. Yeah, I know. It's always the big question: will he or won't he? And it's hard to tell. It really is. I mean, he loves the job. We know that. And you know, when you love the job and your ratings are high, it's pretty hard to give it up, but nevertheless, it's difficult to tell. And I do know that, you know, there are some Democrats waiting in the wings who probably would be very, very sad when he says, if he does say he's going to run again, because I know that they have their eyes on the governorship. And so, it's so hard to tell. It really is. I don't know what to make of it, but I you know, a lot of people say, well, he's maybe tiring a little bit, but mm-hmm. I don't see it.
No, he looks good. He looks good.
Yeah, he looks great, and he's doing, you know, his ratings are good, and
yeah,
people like him, and I think he knows if he runs again, he'll have a very, very strong chance of winning.
Yeah, you know, one of my guests who I have on here, Gary, regularly, Terry Cowgill from the Connecticut News Junkie, he floated something interesting the last time he was on, and he said, you know what, he's probably in good shape now, but again, you know, you have there's all these little kind of, not little, but these mounting scandals there with the gentleman who was running the state college and university system. You got the Costas Diamantis thing. You got the money, you know, you got the rat hole of money for the state pier. And now you've got this stuff with Deirdre Giffords there. You have the Terrence Cheng stuff. You know, you wonder, Gary, if he runs and if a Republican really can challenge him, do they challenge him on a corruption line? I don't know, but Terry had floated that. What do you think?
You know, I think that would be very hard to run on and to make some of those you know, claims stick with, mm-hmm. with Lamont, because you know, you mentioned the Costas you know, Diamantis issue and then Chang, and you know, I don't want to say that he's a Teflon governor, but so far he doesn't seem in any way whatsoever to be you know, deemed responsible for either of those. And I think he's kept his distance pretty well from those scandals. And I don't see those scandals as in any way, shape or form, you know, having the potential to bring him down.
Yeah.
I don't believe that they are, any Republican could use those effectively. I don't see it.
And the thing, Gary, before we shift to the national scene here, the thing that's interesting is he's got, if you go by those morning consult numbers, and he's always like the second or third highest rated governor in the country, he's got 63%, which if you do the simple math, even a dummy like me can do that. That's more than just Democrats. When you're drawing 63% here in the state, you have some cross-party appeal, don't you?
You really really do. That's right. And he does very well among unaffiliated voters. You know, there's 41% of the registered voters in Connecticut are unaffiliated. Mm. So many of them do lean towards the Democratic Party in this state. And, you know, he's got his natural Democratic base, and then he's got a large number of unaffiliated voters that lean Democrat. So, I mean, you mentioned those figures there. That's going to be very hard for any Republican to overcome. And Lamont has a I don't want to say it's a machine, but nevertheless, it's almost like the old Democratic machine that used to govern this state, and it really is in his favor. You know, heading if in fact he makes a declaration to run again, it's definitely in his favor.
Yeah, sounds like he has to check with the boss, like we all have to at one time or another, right?
Yeah. He's a very popular governor.
Yeah.
And he has a lot of people like him personally. And he actually does work across the aisle at times pretty effectively. And, you know, I had a good conversation with him once when he was visiting our university.
Oh, really?
And he was talking about how there are Republicans in the legislature that he considers his allies, interestingly enough. And so he's very good, I think, at forging coalitions.
Well, Gary, he does not like to raise taxes. He'll nickel and dime a fee there or this year, but if somebody in his caucus says, well, we're going to raise this tax, 10 minutes later he comes out and says, no, you're not.
That's right. That's exactly right. And, you know, the fiscal guardrails, that's really pretty pretty popular. And so he is some people, you know, who don't like his issues will call him far left, but he's not. He's a very centrist Democrat. And in a state like Connecticut here, which is a moderately liberal state, I mean, he could really win again. But, you know, it's governors. John Rowland went for a third term, and of course, you know what happened to that then. And so normally we have this long tradition. I mean, there's nothing in the state constitution that prohibits it, but we have a long tradition of governors not running for a third term.
Yeah.
John Rowland broke that, and he ended up in federal prison eventually. I don't know but nevertheless, he loves his job, and he's doing a good job, and I think there's going to be a lot of people who are going to want him to run again.
Yeah, certainly does need the money. Dr. Gary Rose, Sacred Heart University. Gary, on the national scene here, briefly, I got to tell you, all these books now are coming out. We've got the Jake Tapper book. We've got a couple of other two or three books. I have a couple of them on a pre-order from Amazon on Audible. And boy, the all of a sudden, Gary, and I predicted this last year, as you probably did, they are right. I mean, the Democratic Party, my God, they are running from Joe Biden like it's a fire drill. Oh, my God.
Yes. A couple of those books, too. I've read Fight and also Uncharted.
Yeah.
Yes, I know. And oh my gosh, he's a pariah right now for anybody who wants to run again. They have to distance themselves from Biden. I mean, his approval ratings really went way down. And then, of course, the whole business, the way he was conducting himself in that debate. After that, I think that it's really, you keep him, you know, at arm's length, and you don't want to, be affiliated with Joe Biden. And I think people looking at what happened to Kamala Harris, because she didn't distance herself enough from Biden.
Yeah.
And when she was, you know, selected as the candidate after he withdrew, and we know, everybody knows what happened to her. So I think that as the presidential, you know, after the midterm election, it really is going to crank up. But you're not going to hear much about Joe Biden. I think that a lot of the Democrats who have their eyes on the presidency are going to keep him as far away as possible. And he is not in any way whatsoever an asset to a candidate running for president on the Democratic side.
Dr. Gary Rose, Sacred Heart University political science professor and scholar in residence. Gary, always good to check in with you. Be good, and we'll chat down the road. Thank you, sir.
Okay, sure. Take care, Paul.
Thanks, Gary. Appreciate it. Dr. Gary Rose there, Sacred Heart University. All right, you're hearing in the top of the hour, national news here, top and bottom of the hour from CBS, reports about arguments, oral arguments today, the U.S. Supreme Court, regarding what they call birthright citizenship that was ensconced in the Constitution back post-Civil War, but now is being challenged by the Trump White House and analyzing that for us. A return visit from Thane Rosenbaum, CBS News legal analyst. Thane, good afternoon, sir. How are you?
Great hearing your voice, Paul. Very fine. Thank you.
And thanks for joining us. By the way, we should mention, check out Thane's website, which, oddly enough, is ThaneRosenbaum.com. So how about that? it's for simple guys like me, Thane. Okay, so birthright citizenship, like, this is something we kind of learned, I remember, in high school, about if you're born here on U.S. soil or, I guess, in the U.S. territory, you're a U.S. citizen, no matter what the state of mom or dad or whoever bore you. Why is this being challenged, and what did you glean, Thane, if anything, from what you may have read or heard today?
Well, the Trump administration immediately, I think it may have been their very first executive order, implemented a policy that said if your parents are here illegally and they have no legal status while here, meaning not only are they not citizens, but they're not here under a green card or a recognized visa, then you do not receive citizenship through birthright. The argument being that this was, yes, a post-Civil War amendment, but it was there to reflect the citizenship rights that should be granted to African Americans who were brought here mm-hmm. forcibly. It was not intended to deal with this situation at all. On the other hand, you know, in 1898, the Supreme Court actually ruled in a case yeah. where a Chinese American was born in this country. His parents were not citizens. They were citizens of China, but the court ruled that the boy was. So the Supreme Court precedent, although is unchallenged for all these years, is already there. It didn't require the court in 1898 didn't say, well, this only applies to former African slaves. Mm-hmm. They just said it applies as it reads in the Constitution. But, you know, the Trump administration took the view that that the language in the amendment says if you are subject to the jurisdiction of the United States,
yeah.
meaning you may have not been born here, but if you're subject to the jurisdiction of the United States, and they're saying, well, you're not subject to the jurisdiction of the United States if you're not here legally. But that's not true either, because if you commit a crime, you can be taken to jail, and then you are subject to if they can put you in jail for committing a crime, then you are subject to the jurisdiction of the United States. So that's what the case is about. Three states challenged it on behalf of people living in this in their states who are not citizens. One
yeah.
question is, what business was it of the states? By the way, that came up today, right? Who is it? It's one thing for the people to challenge it. It's another thing for the state attorneys general to bring it up. Mm. Why should they care? You know, it has nothing to do with them. State attorneys general deal with consumer welfare, and it shouldn't be involved in this. So that was one idea that came out today. Another idea is, why is this being brought by states at all? Why isn't it just a class action involving everyone from wherever they might be, who was either born here or is about to give birth here? But the interesting thing, Paul,
yeah.
is that the case had nothing to do with this at all, because the Trump administration appealed this to the Supreme Court on an emergency basis. And cases are usually not heard this time late in the year. The Supreme Court at this time of the year is working to finalize the rest of its docket to release the decisions in June. So they don't normally do this. They did this because the Trump administration said, look at all of these nationwide injunctions that have been imposed on
yeah.
all of our executive orders,
yeah.
whether it came to slashing the federal debt or government jobs, any number of issues that wound up in the court where district judges put injunctions, temporary though they may be, and pretty much put a halt to the implementation of the policy. So the court really spent most of its time today,
mm-hmm.
Paul, discussing the legitimacy of a solitary federal judge somewhere, somehow having the power to, you know, the incredible amount of power to say, Mr. President, I know you just won an election, and I know this is one of the things you said you wanted to do,
yeah.
and so you put it in an executive order, but I'm saying you can't do it. And if I say you can't do it, that means you can't even do it in any state anywhere. That's what the court really is going to be deciding,
wow.
whether a judge has the right to interfere with that level of the president's constitutional authority under Article 2, or as liberals would say, that's exactly what judges do. That's what the separation of powers means. It means that even though the judge is unelected, that he and has lifetime appointment, he or she still has that power of oversight over presidential authority.
Well, we shall see what shakes out. Thane Rosenbaum. Thane, as always, great to breaking it down. Appreciate it, Thane. Thank you.
Anytime for you. Thank you.
Appreciate it. Thane Rosenbaum. Check out his website, by the way. Interesting guy, author, talk show host, legal analyst. You just heard it there. Thane, T-H-A-N-E, ThaneRosenbaum.com. As we continue right here on WICC. Needless to say, there are likely young folks born here in the USA within maybe the boundaries of the great sovereign state of Connecticut, the Democratic People's Republic of Connecticut, the real DPRC, born here in Connecticut, who are, under the 14th Amendment to the U.S. Constitution passed post-Civil War, those are young folks born here. Maybe they're not young anymore. They may have been born here despite their parents not being U.S. citizens or not having legal standing. And this goes back to the 14th Amendment that was, again, made to or put into place and hammered through by then-President Abraham Lincoln to make sure the offspring, the kids of slaves, freed slaves, were U.S. citizens. Well, the Trump White House trying to make changes in that. Our second opinion of the day on what would happen today in the U.S. Supreme Court. And obviously, and also on two different levels here, the 14th Amendment itself and these nationwide injunctions that judges have been using to slow down the Trump White House. One of our go-to folks, Landmark Legal Foundation, VP of Legal Affairs, Mike O'Neill, joins us to talk about that. Mike, good afternoon, sir. How are you?
I'm great, Paul. Always a pleasure to be with you.
Thank you, sir, for taking the time, Mike. I know you're super busy. So before we get to the nationwide injunction thing here,
okay.
The first issue, the 14th Amendment, I think I summarized it pretty well. We learned about this in high school on up through college. So what is the Trump White House trying to do here? And what did you sense, Mike? I know you have pretty good antenna about this, as to what you heard maybe from the justices today.
Well, I don't think you're going to get a substantive ruling on that particular issue because the government was very careful to frame the issue before the court. Though the vehicle was this executive order that involved the revocation of the birthright citizenship for individuals who are born in America, the birthright citizenship issue. Though the government was very careful to frame the issue squarely before the court, the issue of universal injunctions. However, there was invariably when you have over 2 hours of oral arguments, there's going to be you're going to get some sense of where the justices are kind of falling on this issue because of course it is the issue when you're issuing an injunction, it's likelihood of success on the merits. So ultimately, this is the issue which the case will turn on a merits case, on a merits level. So I think you saw the so-called liberal bloc. Sotomayor spoke extensively today, not amenable to the constitutionality or legality of the executive order. In other words, birthright citizenship should apply. There are Supreme Court cases that support that notion. So I think that's going to be a fairly close call when it migrates to the court on a merits level. I don't think you're going to get a decision specifically on the constitutionality or the legality of the executive order in June or July. I think that might come next term once the merits of the cases have come up. Sorry to disappoint you. I wish I could give you a little more substance
but
it really was a subsidiary issue that was presented to the court today. Right now, I would say the Trump administration has been losing. I don't think they've had a successful a judge, but of course, a lot of the judges that have been forum shopped have been particularly picked because they know that they're going to be predisposed to ruling against the Trump administration.
I was going to say before we get to the judge shopping thing and the nationwide injunction. Yeah. So, I mean, could this court? I mean, what if the court came out maybe next year, or the year after, as you said, this 14th Amendment thing, this was from a different time, and we didn't have the immigration problems. I mean, the Supreme Court can't invalidate an amendment to the Constitution, or can they?
No, but they can interpret it as such to when I'm just advocating devil's advocate.
Yeah.
When the time at the enactment and the enactment of the 14th Amendment, it was not simply limited to the descendants of slaves, the children of slaves. That's the argument.
Okay.
Of course, the 14th Amendment was entitled so that the descendants of slaves, that the children of slaves would have citizenship, born in the United States. However, Justice Sotomayor actually raised an issue. She raised the term gypsies, that there is some maybe original understanding of the 14th Amendment that it wasn't simply designed just to apply to children of slaves. Huh. I'm not versed in that history. I'm more prone to the history regarding the slaves. And I don't think that I don't know whether there's an originalist argument or an argument to proffer. However, I think that there's probably some argument that they can cobble together to maybe support that. And one interesting thing on this is during oral arguments, Justice Kavanaugh noted some of the practical problems if suddenly this executive order were to immediately go into effect. Again, there was a 30-day period for implementation of the executive order. But imagine if it went into effect. Justice Kavanaugh noted some practical problems. Babies born in a hospital, and well, what are we supposed to do with that? Are these going to – and then advocates for overturning the executive order were saying there's going to be all kinds of practical issues about this and how the agency is going to comply with this. So there are a host of issues to arise if you interpret it, if you decide that this executive order is constitutional, is permissible and unconstitutional.
Wow.
So there's some problems with it. Turning real quickly to the issue strictly before the court. And then again, this is the universal injunctions.
Yep.
Now we know there's about 675 district courts in the country. And the issue here is whether any one of these district courts can issue an injunction that would apply to the entire country.
Yeah.
And I would submit to you, and I think I've said it to you on your show before, that I don't think that this was ever intended by the framers, since we're getting into the intent. And this kind of came up with Justice Thomas today. He actually stated, he noted that.
Wait a minute. He spoke?
Oh, yeah. Absolutely.
Just kidding.
He speaks fairly regularly these days. So he said he noted that the important historical fact that there was no such thing as a universal injunction prior to 1960. And so he said, well, the country managed to survive up until 1960 without district court judges having this equitable power to implement nationwide injunctions. And so I thought that was kind of an interesting point and kind of telegraphed where Justice Thomas was sitting on this issue. Broadly speaking, I think this is going to be a close call, Paul.
Yeah.
I know you always like me to kind of break it down. I think you saw Justice Barrett was on both sides of the fence on this. Justice Kavanaugh, I think, you know, we're always talking about them as the swing justices. Justice Kavanaugh is kind of a stickler for procedure, and I think he does see the fact that there is an opportunity to use a class certification, and that's kind of the outlet for these groups. Instead of having a universal injunction, these groups that want to seek widespread injunction, for example, individuals, again, who are representing, you know, children born to illegal immigrants.
Sure.
He could say that they could be certified as a class. There's a particular rule in place, and that rule should be applicable rather than just having the power, this equitable power to courts that issue nationwide injunctions. So you saw Justice Kavanaugh coming down on one end. You probably saw Amy Coney Barrett expressing some skepticism on that position. Justice Roberts, again, when we're talking about these swing justices, I think indicated he kind of was telegraphing that he would be on the side of ruling that curbing the power of the district court judges, saying that they don't necessarily have this power to issue universal injunctions. Justice Gorsuch asked a lot of pertinent questions, so I might put him in the swing. Interestingly here, one final point on this is Justice Kagan had actually previously come out expressing skepticism about the power of district judges to issue universal injunctions. But again, the context when she was speaking in was when conservative groups were going into seeking judges to enjoin the Biden administration to taking action.
Of course.
That's kind of ironic. She might be, you know, she might have to come back and eat her own words on some of that stuff. So she's kind of, I don't know, she's kind of bound by maybe something she'd said in the past. Some of these just, so if you want to count it out on paper, if you look to their previous statements and their previous writings, at least the majority of the justices would say the courts don't have the power to utilize universal injunctions. However, based on oral arguments today, I think it's going to be a little closer call.
Wow. Great stuff as always. Yeah. Folks, check it out online. Landmark Legal Foundation, our buddy Mike O'Neill. Mike, thanks as always. Be good.
Take care, Paul. Bye-bye.
Appreciate it. So there you have it, folks. Between Mike O'Neill and Thane Rosenbaum, I think we gave you a good breakdown.